Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Been left to Chris Wyatt, and how well he did that again. Scott Quinnell, a bust by Scott Gibbs. Scott Gibbs is through. Scott Gibbs has scored. What an amazing...
Welcome to the Attacking Scrum Podcast Lions Preview. We've had a couple of weeks off to recharge the batteries, and Dan Killick is like a caged animal ready to get stuck into Lions chat. We've also got a few other things to talk about as well. It's been a busy couple of weeks while we've been off. We've also got the reformed Pro 14-16. It's going to be called the United Rugby Championship, which is something to look forward to. We'll get stuck into that, get the boys' opinions on that. Alex Cuthbert is heading back to Wales. Corey Hill is heading away from Wales. So, yeah, no shortage of stuff going on in the 2 weeks that we've been absent. But as I say, our very own Gavin Henson, we've managed his game time very, very carefully, and he's here. He's promised us a massive performance. How are you, Dan?
Yeah, I'm very good, Jed. Feeling fresh, as you said, and sporting quite a nice tan, which I know you haven't picked up on yet, but it's not bad, is it?
No, we haven't picked up tans ourselves either, have we? But judging by the state of us,
no, a little bit pale. Got a bit of work to do, but yeah, I've had a couple of weeks off. Had been to the Lake District, down to Wittering. A period of isolation as well, so it's been all systems go.
I did enjoy that the other day when you said, oh, I can't do a podcast because I'm in isolation. I haven't seen you face to face for close to 2 years now. We've been doing all of these via Zoom, so why you're in isolation made any difference? I don't know. I think you might have momentarily believed the daydream that you were Gavin Henson and we were going into training. But Mighty Murph's here to officiate with us as well. How you doing, Murph?
Good, thanks. You?
Yeah, good. Let's start. Let's dive straight in with the Lions, shall we? Because it's only a couple of days away. We've had the team announcement. We've got the first game up at Murrayfield against Japan, a game which we're not sure whether it's got test status or not. I think it even cropped up in Gatland's press conference the other day. Someone asked him whether it should have test status or not, which is all a little bit odd. But nonetheless, we have a game to look forward to. Dan, how excited are you about the Lions tour beginning?
I'm really excited for it to get going. It isn't the same, is it, as Lions tours that we've known previously, but I'm still excited by it, I've got to be honest.
What about you, Murph?
I wish the whole thing was on Channel 4 instead of just the pre-tour cash-in.
I tell you what I've enjoyed over the last, well, enjoyed slash not enjoyed, is a couple of these kind of semi-nostalgic pieces doing the rounds about the game in 2005, the test match against Argentina that was played in Cardiff. I don't know if either of you boys went to that game.
Probably not, because they had a new baby in the house.
Yeah,
I missed it. I remember watching it, though.
Yeah, it was a stinker of a game. I went.
Yeah. Are they always though?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the only one I think I remember in my lifetime that's been played over here.
No, I just mean these pre-tour games that they stage are always a damn scurvy. Like it wasn't awful, but the last tour playing the Barbars in Hong Kong.
Oh yeah, it was 8 years ago, wasn't it?
38 degrees and 120% humidity, like.
And also, like, you know, I think the Barbas now, or certainly for a period after that, did at least do a little bit of training, whereas they'd clearly just been on the source for days and pitched up, and it was, yeah, it was a shambles. It was a shambles of a game, wasn't it?
Which, and there was Niggle, which I thought was odd.
It was what, sorry?
Niggle in it.
Yeah, what was it? Shout Brits and Owen Farrell having a bit of a dust up, I think, I seem to remember. And they were teammates at the time as well. Yeah. So it was a bit odd.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a terrible game. So I'm hoping that Saturday doesn't have a similar thing in there. I just think generally the Lions works better away from home, doesn't it? Because, it, you know, they're a touring side and you put aside your national allegiances to pull on the red jersey and what have you. But yeah, I don't know. Obviously, it might be a bit different this time around because I think everyone's been so starved of live sports that if you're one of the lucky 15,000 to be in Murrayfield, you'll, I don't know, maybe appreciate it a bit more.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult one for you to sort of, as a player, to really get into, because you kind of, like you said, you expect to be away from, you know, away from home, getting on a plane, getting literally away, and then it starts. So it's almost got like a feel of like a training ground session. Yeah, it's going to be watched. There's going to be, you know, people forming opinions on it, and probably a stock can rise or fall depending on the game. But mentally, I think it's a real difficult switch on, really, for the boys, I reckon.
Yeah, it's true. And also, you've got the Premiership final taking place on the same day, which is just one of these things that makes rugby look really amateur, isn't it? You know, the fact that you're not able to pick a load of players because they're taking place in the biggest game in English rugby. So you're not able to call upon them. So it's one of the frustrations.
I would say that's the other way. When you said it makes the game look really amateur, when the game was amateur, there was no issue with clashes.
No, there wasn't, because no one was out for making money.
And also, this game would be on a Wednesday afternoon in the Arms Park at 2:30 kickoff, and everyone would be like taking time off work and school to go and watch it. That's how we used to work. So it's actually a sign. The fact that it clashes with everything is a sign of professionalism, really, because no one's willing to get out of the way. Everyone's got vested interest, and you know, that's how it is. Obviously, you're right, it does show like an amateurish running of the game because they haven't structured the season to, you know, but I mean, obviously they've got an excuse in a COVID year, but it happens to the Lions every 4 years now. Is you start the tour and certain people have only just arrived. So yeah, it wasn't an issue in the old days. They were all given 6 months off work to get on the boat, but to play 40 matches on a tour, you know, that kind of nonsense.
Do you know what? I looked something up the other day. Again, just got stuck in like a Wikipedia wormhole looking at nonsense when I should have been working. And the 97 Lions tour, which obviously isn't, you know, it doesn't feel that long ago, and obviously was just in the professional era. Straight away after that tour, England went down to Australia and played, and their Lions went and played with them, or certainly most of them did. So whoever was in this, you know, Greenwood and John Bentley got like added his one and only other cap in that game, in a game afterwards, which is just mad, isn't it? To think you'd, after that tour, you'd head straight down there and take a kick in off Australia.
I don't remember that at all. Oh, no, to Australia they went, did they?
To Australia, yeah.
Right, okay. No, I don't remember that at all.
I think, yeah, I don't know. It might have, I can't remember if it was that same tour when they took like a 98-0 shoeing, which started the kind of, I don't know, it might have been a few years later, but it started the kind of, they said they learned a lot off that tour anyway, and then obviously went on and won a World Cup a few years later.
Any English player who was in the Lions test team would have been burnt out completely before the start of, you know, that English tour. So, like, you know, there was good players who, Tim Rodber and the likes of them, you know. So, yeah,
that's a good boy, good player, only Tim Rodber.
Yeah, he's a big fan, like one of those grudging, you know, grudging.
Yeah.
Oh, he's one of those I've got no problem liking because he had his best games in a red shirt rather than a white one. You know, I think that's the, well, in my memory as well, like Simon Shaw's another one of those where, you know, he might have had 60 odd caps for England, but I remember him more than anything playing for the Lions. Tom Croft, another one. Yeah, you know, it's they're those players that it's a lot easier to like because they generally haven't scored tries against Wales.
Mm.
So it's not begrudging.
Just going back to the game on Saturday again.
Thanks, Murph.
You're welcome. Yeah. Well, I was going to mention Tim Robb, but when the first tour they did to South Africa after South Africa had been let back into international rugby, I think it was 94 or maybe before that, and it was all televised. I don't know what it must have been, like ITV or something.
I remember
Tim,
it, yeah.
Tim Robb was immense in that. That's when I started the fandom of Tim Robb. But going back to Saturday, at least Japan will be trying to play some rugby. Like yeah. We're not. It's not like a, you know, like Argentina in the past or the Barbas and then that. They're open play type of side. So it should be, fingers crossed, it should be bearable, and not too much of a mess. You know, is the sport and the tour and everyone in doesn't gain anything by it being. Stop start load of referee dominated shite. So hopefully everyone enters into the spirit of it.
Well, look, I think if any side is gonna want to do that, it's Japan. They haven't played a huge amount of rugby since the World Cup either. They played a game against the Sunwolves the other day, which you know, obviously I think they've kind of dragged out of their hiatus to play one game together. So I think, you know, it's a good opportunity for them. They don't get enough opportunities on the world stage outside of the World Cup, in my opinion. So for them, it's a really good opportunity to lay down a mark. And I think they'll be gunning for it because it's the Lions' first trip out. So it does add a little bit more to it.
Yeah.
With that in mind, Dan, I suppose it's not necessarily ideal preparation for South Africa if you're playing a side who's, you know, fast and mobile and wants to run it from everywhere. You know, is that a good thing, bad thing? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think potentially we've got to make sure that Lions try and play to, I suppose, a style that they're gonna be adopting, you know, to go out and take on South Africa, really. I think if we try and take them on with a different type of game plan, then it could, I don't know how much we'd really get from it other than a sort of a real blowout. And the biggest thing, I think most important thing is to work the combinations, really, of which there's quite a few across the side, isn't there?
There are. Should we do a quick recap of the side just to...
The change today, didn't it?
There was. Tipperick has come in for Hamish Watson, which I believe is a training ground concussion. So just quickly running through the side, starting with the backs, Liam Williams, Josh Adams, Robbie Henshaw, Bundy Aki, Duan van der Merwe, Dan Bigger and Connor Murray. And then Roy Sutherland, Ken Owens, Xander Ferguson, Ian Henderson, Alan Wynne-Jones, Tyge Byrne, Justin Tipperick, Jack Conan. And then on the bench is Jamie George, Wynne-Jones, Tyge Furlong, Courtney Laws, Toby Faletau, Ali / Tommy Price, Owen Farrell, sorry, and yeah. Anthony Watson on the bench.
Dim slice, as they say.
It's, I mean, looking at the lineup as well, Dan, you're talking about a style of play. It doesn't scream we're going to chuck it around, does it? Murray and Bigger halfbacks and van der Merwe on the wing and Aki and Henshaw. It kind of screams that we're going to get physical and try and blow you away. Anything to suggest that won't be the case?
Yeah, I think when you look at the backs, it definitely looks that way, doesn't it? With the if you says it all with the centre partnership, doesn't it? But also that centre partnership knows themselves really well, don't they? And then you can link into that, you know, Murray and Byrne then as well in at six. I think it's going to be a fairly direct game, doesn't it? But with a good bit of pace, you know, pace out wide and a 15 as well. We've got to be looking at direct route there, haven't we? Route one.
I think so. Murph, how much do you think this team selection reflects what Gatland's going to do, or is it just a question of who's available?
Yeah, obviously there's two sides, English sides, playing tomorrow, so they're not going to be involved. But I think if you look across the squad, I mean, there's no like mercurial centre play throughout the squad anyway, is it? You know, so
not really.
The selection for Saturday, even if everyone was available, they're not. You wouldn't imagine a side being picked that looks like they're going to turn into the Harlem Globetrotters, if you know what I mean.
No, so, I think perhaps you might look at Finn Russell at 10 and suggest that might have opened things up a bit. You could look at if Hogg was available, that having him do a bit of a dual playmaker role might suggest that. But I don't know. I think you're right. I generally, the squad
Elliot when we Daly at 13 Elliot might Daly, suggest you're more expansive, but he's not a massive distributor of the ball anyway. So. You're right about Finn Russell, and there's no reason why they couldn't pick him. You know, he's not still playing in France, is he?
I think they've got a semi-final or final. Yeah. Like the season goes on for like 4 years every in France, doesn't it? So
yeah. So yeah, I thought up there at Murrayfield he might have had a run out first out, but obviously he couldn't pick him anyway. I had forgotten about France still playing. Yeah, they do, don't they? But he is, you know, he's aside from, you know, attacking wingers and what have you. He is the most attacking, and Stuart Hogg, but you know, Stuart Hogg can only get on the end of things, really.
Yeah.
So really speaking, I mean, Owen Farrell's not a creative 10. So the centres are similar. So it's only really Finn Russell who's going to be the go-to guy if they need to mix it up, really. So, the main thing is, though, is that apart from anything else, you know, style of play aside, is getting to know each other on the pitch. Yeah. Obviously, they'll be doing loads of male bonding in the background in their training sessions and in their bubbles and all that. But there's nothing like under pressure on the pitch in a game to get to know each other. So that's just all it is, really.
How much pressure do you think there is on them to get the result and get underway with a bang, Dan? I think that, you know, if it had been, you know, like if... Take the four years ago, you know, if they'd have lost to New Zealand Barbarians in the first game, it maybe wouldn't have mattered too much because you could have said, well, you know, they've only had 4 days since they've landed. Whereas this feels a bit more because they're going with a very strong side. If they were to lose this one, it would put a bit of pressure on them, don't you think?
I do think it would heap the pressure on. Yeah, I do. I think it's very different if you lose a game when you've actually been on the plane. And got over there. But this is, you know, if the Lions end up losing to, you know, to Japan, then which could happen, you know, that could happen. It really would add the pressure on, and you know, the press over in SA will really wind it up, won't they? And because of that, I think it is one of those games which has to be a sort of must win, just because that pressure starts to build, doesn't it? When you know, it's for intents and purposes, it's a bit of a sort of I don't know. There's not a huge amount on it, is there? Other than we got to sort of get through it, get a win, and then get on the plane.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult one. Like you said, they've got to get that win, I think, but also it is a banana skin because Japan will know each other very very well and will be coming out and wanting to lay down a marker. So. Yeah, well, you mentioned it right at the top of the show. That motivation, I think, is going to be crucial. That, you know, not that I'm saying they won't be motivated, but they've got to come out at test match level mentality, really, because it is a tricky fixture with a side who know each other well, and we know what Japan are capable of when they play their best stuff.
Yeah, totally. I think also you've got, again, from the mental side of it, how you can get yourself up for the game when there's, you know, the team really is kind of picked and decided by external factors in terms of the other, you know, a lot of the boys not being available. So you're sort of in the side, but would you really be in the side? And then also you don't want to get an injury. You're desperate not to get an injury in this game that then rules you out, because, you know, yes, you're putting on the Lions shirt, but I think it's like putting on a training ground top, isn't it? It's not, you're not wearing the Lions shirt until you're over there.
That's true.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, imagine picking up a knock in this game and not even being able to get on the plane. I know, obviously, we covered this. It was a really unfortunate situation that Andrew Porter found himself in, and he won't get out. And that happens every time. But it would be particularly cruel to get to put your Lions shirt on, but not to actually make it onto the plane. It just feels like a very difficult one. But you can't go into a test match with that mentality of not wanting to get injured, can you? Or any match for that matter.
Well, I was convinced Manu Tuilagi was going to end up on this tour.
He's pulled out of the England A game, hasn't he?
Yeah. Being replaced in the squad, which is even worse.
Right, good point.
So, he's not going to get the call up now for the Lions. But I felt surely, he just looked in his comeback at, what, the three games maybe for Sale? He just looked so strong. They were purring about him in Sale before he went on the pitch. But when he was actually playing matches, he just looked ridiculous. He's 30 years old now as well. He's had so many seasons disrupted by injury. But he just looked really good. And I thought, first sign of any injury, whatever position in the backs, they'd probably go for Manu. And that was the end of him this week. It's like a commentator's curse. Although I didn't say it out loud on telly or anything. But what was the question?
Not sure there was one.
Yeah, we just butted in. Yeah.
The long and the short of it is you're right, Manu won't be going out there. Quick subplot though. A very quick subplot. Josh Navidi made it into the Wales squad.
That's a surprise to me.
Well, it was a surprise to me as well. Maybe he's working his way back to full fitness and he might just make it out there after all. Who knows?
Yeah, well, we'd said it, when he was left, he'd definitely be first reserve, but we weren't aware of how severe his shoulder injury was.
But you were, Murph, because his ex-teammates were tipping you off.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. But if we'd known, we would, So now, because we would then found out how severe his shoulder, we said, well, he's got no chance. But it depends, how fully fit is he? And like, if he plays for Wales in the first test and goes well, then maybe the Lions would consider him as a replacement. But I think fresh off the physio bench, I don't think the Lions, they don't need to. They don't need to turn to him. But if he has a game and he goes well, then it's a possibility.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. The first test is against Canada as well, isn't it? Which doesn't hold, to use my horse racing form analogy, it's a bit of a canter at, it's a canter at Foss Lass on a Tuesday, isn't it? Rather than rather than Gold Cup form, that one, I think. Hopefully we don't lose that now. just quickly to wrap up on the Lions, before we go to a quick break and then have a look at a few other things in the second half. I don't know about you fellows. I mean, obviously I know Dan seems super keen, but I almost feel like this has just crept up on me a bit. I think with all the other sport that's going on at the moment, particularly the Euros and stuff, it does feel very, very different to a normal year. I don't know whether that will change when they get out to South Africa. And obviously, things die down with the football, but you're not normally competing with a major football tournament, plus all the other stuff that's postponed, plus you've got the Olympics and stuff coming on. I don't know, in my head, I was thinking this is going to be this amazing summer of sport. And now I'm just thinking, well, there's so many things that I'm not even keeping up. There's a cricket match going on in Cardiff right now, that there's an international game I didn't even realise was.
No, I didn't. No. I just, And they've got spectators as well.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? Just I think almost it's just like such a glut of sport happening at once. I think the Lions will kick into full swing. I just think for me at the moment, it feels a little bit like the phony war before we get underway.
Yeah, I agree. They always. I mean, like I said at the top of the podcast, they always do feel like a cash in. I know they do serve a purpose because everyone gets a run out, but they do feel like they're. Because if this was fully attended, those tickets to watch the Lions on a pre-tour game, they're not cheap. They're full price Twickenham type jobs.
I know, I had one. it saved me a few bob not being able to go. But
how did you have one so early?
General sale. My mate Ollie, who in fact has been came on the pod a few years ago on the last Lions tour, he bought them and I actually ended up having a rescheduled stag do for my mate, which is going on this weekend. So I said, I should go on. I'm going to go on that one, And as it happened, we lost our tickets anyway, but they've booked accommodation up in Scotland and everything. So at the moment, they're trying to find pubs that are showing the bloody game, trying to get a booking, which is even harder than getting a ticket. So, good luck to those boys.
How did you lose the tickets?
So they haven't lost the tickets, but originally it was going to be fully open and then it became a reduced capacity. So they've ended up getting a refund on the tickets, but having booked accommodation to go out to Murrayfield, and all the pubs are fully booked.
Yeah.
Enough.
They're still in quite heavy restrictions up there as well, aren't they? So
yeah, they are. It's more, yeah.
Oh, so are we in Cardiff.
Yeah, exactly.
Six to a team.
They should head to Glasgow. It's a great, great night out.
I'm not sure it is right now, mate. I think it probably is in normal times, but yeah, at the moment it might be a bit different.
If you look long enough, there's always some establishment flouting the rules, and you just walk in and everyone's stood up at the bar. That's been I can't name names, but that's been happening around the country.
Yeah.
Keep looking, boys. I'm sure you'll find it. But while we're talking Edinburgh and Glasgow, we're going to be talking about them a little bit more when it comes into the second half, because we're going to be talking about the United Rugby Championship, as it will now be known. And I'm keen to get your boys' thoughts on that. We'll be doing that after this very, very quick break. Welcome to the second half of the Attacking Scrum podcast. I mentioned in the first half there was some cricket going on at the same time. We've no idea what's going on in that. Murph's given us an update in the Euros, and we're both sat here cursing Dan Killick because he's meant we're missing it. So I hope you appreciate it. That's what we're doing for you. We're missing some genuinely exciting football to talk about the Pro 16. or as it is now known, the United Rugby Championship. So we've had a change in name, a change in format, some more teams added, which I think we knew was going to happen anyway. It's going back to a league structure of sorts. We've got the South African teams being eligible for the Heineken Cup. There's quite a lot actually in this. I'm surprised it's not made more news outside of the odd Western Mail article there. Any thoughts from you boys? Who wants to start us on this one?
I don't mind.
Go on, Murph, get in there.
I was shocked by the access into the European Cup that the South African sides have got. I just assumed France and England would object, you know, because it's kind of their baby these days, let's be honest, apart from the odd appearance from Leinster and what have you. But, very surprised. I mean, that transformed, it's not just this URC thing. Have I got that right? URC or UCR?
UFC.
yeah, UFC 2005. It not only transforms the Celtic League as it was back in the day, it transforms the European Cup, because it's not the European Cup anymore. It's the, I don't know what the Cup it is, but now, you know, potentially the best side in South Africa could dominate European Cup. It's not called the European Cup, I know that, but the Champions Cup for the next so many seasons, in the same way as, say, Saracens have done in the past, or Leinster.
Yeah, Toulouse and Toulon and the likes, yeah.
Yeah, we could end up in a situation like that, which is going to feel really weird. And I mean, I suppose this exciting in a way, but I just wasn't expecting this scenario to lead to that situation. And there's been no... From what I can tell, there's been no reaction over the border. They don't seem to have even blatted an eyelid at the fact that the Bulls and the Stormers are going to be going head-to-head with, you know, Exeter and Bristol. And next season, Saracens will be back.
Well, I'm looking forward to the South African derby between Saracens and the Bulls. They haven't got as many South Africans as they used to, have they?
Sale versus
the
Bulls.
Sale, that's the one. That's what
big SA loving.
Yeah, my... my English rugby knowledge is a good 10 years out of date there, isn't it?
But Richmond got a lot of them as well, yeah.
Hey, I tell you, you're going back that far. Newport had them all.
Yeah.
Right, let us look in this in further detail, though, because, you're absolutely right, Murph. It's really interesting. But there's something else that I find a little bit strange about this is the qualification has gone back to being not a meritocracy, if you know what I mean. So the qualification for Europe is not a straightforward top six or top eight. It's based on geography again. So the top team from each of the national pools, in inverted commas. So just to recap, it will be organized as a league season. So there will be there'll be the 16 teams in there, and then it will go to playoffs after that. But that won't determine who qualifies for Europe. There'll be national pools, and the top ranked side out of each of those will qualify for the Heineken Cup. And then after that, it will go down to league positions. So let's say, for example, the Bulls finished top of the South African pool. They would qualify for Europe. But the Stormers might finish second in the league overall behind the Bulls, and Leinster would qualify for Europe ahead of them, if you see what I mean.
Right. So how many places are we getting, though?
Eight, I believe.
No, how many in Wales?
Oh, in Wales. So one, guaranteed, plus then down to league rankings.
See, because if you remember, the big reorganization of the Heineken Cup
was to stop all this.
Yeah.
That's another thing. There's been no noise because England and France kicked up such a stink about about Leinster putting out their resis every week and then coming fully loaded to the Heineken Cup. But they've proven that they can put out their resis every week, still win the league, and then win the Heineken Cup as well. So it's a strange one. But also, this is a really strange thing. There was an interview with Martin and I, the CEO of the URC, as it now is, with BBC Wales middle of last week, I think. And he basically kind of said, we're going to need financial regulation in this league. Now, the Irish have been bang against that, but I've not heard a huge amount that says, you know, that says that they're kind of disagreeing with any of this. So I don't know, the whole thing just feels a little bit strange compared to what the power struggle we've had over the previous decade.
I honestly think a lot of people, obviously, it's not next season because they're going to play a qualification season, the South African sides, in this new league before they go into Europe. I think a lot of people have been sleeping on this and will be in shock when they realise who's going to be lining up against their clubs.
Maybe it goes back to our point about this summer of sport, everything kind of being buried a little bit. Normally an announcement like this on a wet and windy November when there's nothing else going on might have made a bit more of an impact. Or maybe it's an indictment on how bad the league has become, that no one really pays any attention to any news headlines it generates.
On a slow news day, it would have got some coverage. But you're right. There's too much going on for it to even surface. That's it.
There you go. So yeah, there's a few interesting political subplots that go with it. But to come back to the format, Dan, it kind of moves back towards a league structure. It's got a new name and some new teams. Is this a step in the right direction for it being a more competitive, meaningful league? There's less clash with international fixtures as well. What are your thoughts on the competition overall?
Yeah, I think it should become more competitive, shouldn't it? There's probably going to be a little bit more interest surrounding it. But I don't know. It doesn't still. You know, I'm usually the optimistic one here, and I can't really get excited by it at all. Who can really? I mean, we're going back to your point about the that whole sort of meritocracy and there being no noise over the border. It is totally like it hasn't hit there. It hasn't landed. It's just not hit. It's just not hit the press at all, isn't it? Because you do, I can imagine it almost go, you'd think it would go down like a lead balloon. But it's like, no problem. Yeah. Happy days.
Do you think it could be a move? And again, I'm getting very, what's the word, big picture here. But is this a move towards something much, much bigger in 3-4 years' time? You know,
I think it is.
Some kind of world league, some kind of world club cup that you have both, both hemispheres taking part in.
It certainly
Or is it just a case that South Africa haven't been able to find a home for their teams, and this is the, you know, the next obvious thing?
I would say the most likely thing is desperation for economically speaking down in South Africa. But it is also like a, if you like, a trial for unifying the seasons between a Southern Hemisphere nation like South Africa and up here. But I, obviously that's much more difficult with New Zealand, Australia, because of the diagonal nature of where they are. They're not, I mean, we're on the same time zone and everything in South Africa. So it does actually work in that regard. But I think primary reason is just cash strapped, and you know, not just cash strapped, but really difficult to keep hold of any of their players in the country. They're all in France and England, so and Ireland. But it would be much harder to integrate the other two major nations. So I think it's just inspiration myself.
Yeah, I think it's somewhere in between. For what it's worth, I think they've made a half decent job of rebranding it, you know, and kind of ditching the Pro. You know, like the Pro 14 was the most unimaginative title in the world, because it's just like, well, you know, how many teams are in the League 14? Are they professional? Yeah. Oh, it's called the Pro 14 then. I was like, at least it's kind of trying something a bit different. It's a bit odd that it's called the Championship when you've already got the Rugby Championship and the RFU Championship and probably a few other championships knocking around. But it's, I don't know. It, at least they've gone and tried to do something a bit fresh rather than trying to expand their really stale tournament. And it's back to a league structure, which I think is better. But I think Dan is right. Like, it's about that overall cross-border interest. I mean, we've said that it's not rippled much attention in England, given the fact that Gloucester might be playing the Bulls at some point in the next 18 months. I also just think, like, it's great for South Africa and it's good that they've got the backing of a good broadcaster in SuperSport over there. But at the same time, are they going to care when the Dragons are playing Treviso? You know, they're not. That's the problem, is there's just too many. And actually, fair play to Benetton for winning the Rainbow Track Cup. But there's just too many fixtures that do not mean anything that go on throughout the course of a league season. I think if you had either a Celtic League, a British and Irish League, an Anglo-Welsh League, something like that, that was your bread and butter, because you've got the history and the rivalries that go with it. And that led into a, you know, more of a World Club Cup at some point. I think that would be great, because you've got the local thing and then it elevates to an international scale afterwards. But on a week-by-week basis, it's hard to get people in Cape Town excited about something happening in Connacht, isn't it? That's what I think. That's where I think it will always suffer from.
Do you think this development pushes the possibility of an Anglo-Welsh League further away?
I don't know.
If it goes quite well, I mean, it's not going to be a massive hit because of what you just said. But if it goes quite well, the English are not, well, like I said before, they all are running a loss, but they're not in any great hurry to integrate the Welsh regions into their league, are they? Because they're gonna have to make room and everything, or split into two conferences, and you know, all the other possibilities.
Yeah, they're not. But at the same time, I think that we've got the kind of the spectre of CVC lurking over everything, which I know I keep coming back to. But they've not played their hand yet. They've still not played their hand. This is the start of something. There must be a degree of CVC influence here, but I feel like this is a bit of a bridging thing for the next three seasons while the TV deals roll out. So while the BT deal finishes with the English Premiership, you know, I think the Premier Sports one runs for 3 or 4 years or whatever. I think the BBC will get involved in some degree with the URC as well. But after that, that kind of gives you enough time, if you're CVC and have enough influence over the global game, to shape something that is going to be of interest to a big sporting audience that's going to generate money. Because this isn't going to generate money in the long run, is it? It's just going to, it's going to paper over some cracks for a little while. The concept of a World Rugby Club Championship could get people interested. You can sell that to someone who likes the Six Nations but doesn't watch any club rugby. You can sell that in as a big Friday, Saturday night fixture. Who's playing? Canterbury Crusaders versus Saracens. the semi-finals of the World Club Rugby Championship, that's something that someone can get behind. So I do still feel like there's a bigger play at hand here in the next few years.
They're just biding their time, aren't they?
I reckon so. I don't know.
Laying low. Well, they are, though, aren't they? They're not, as you said, they're not going to be making any. Those boys want to be making some serious cash, don't they? They're not making it from this. I mean, it's absolutely Mickey Mouse. Compared to what they want to be, what the returns they want, don't they? So they're just lying low for a while.
This development of the UFC, as we're calling it, it could do more for the European tournament than it does for us, for our league. Because, like I say, potentially having the top couple of South African sides heading off against Toulouse and Exeter and everyone else, Leinster, could generate more interest in that tournament than it necessarily would in a league structure. So, yeah, I don't think anyone's really paid attention, are they? So it's going to be very interesting to see how it pans out.
Yeah, it will do. I think you're right. The season after next, when you've got South African sides turning up for the Heineken Cup, it'll be interesting. I just don't know whether it'll be a novelty, or it depends how seriously they take both of these competitions. Because if the South African side suddenly go, do you know what, this is nonsense, you know, we can turn up in Zebra, or we can turn up at Rodney Parade with a B team and beat these guys, and they start, you know, rotating the squad a lot, it's not going to add much to the competition, because again, you're going to end up with a load of dead rubber, meaningless fixtures. With the European Cup or the Heineken Cup, that might be different, because you've got big fixtures that they can kind of get behind, and that's where you're going to see the stars play. You know, your Peter Steph de Toits and these guys coming out and exciting an audience.
Yeah. Another issue, obviously this depends on the structure of the tournament, but as it stands now, if you're in a pool with someone, you play home and away against two different sides. Then in the second round, which is normally December, you play home against someone on the Saturday, and then 7 days later, you play them away. So imagine if you get the Stormers in that fixture, who's going to be up for that? You play play the Stormers in Cardiff, then 7 days later, you're going to play them in, I don't know if Stormers play Durban or somewhere. I don't know if that would work. I don't know if that would work in that regard. But then, you know, in the normal traditional way it works, January, they play one game up here, and then in a piss wet cold, and then 7 days later they're playing down in Cape Town, and it's, you know, it's unbearably hot. So there are some weird aspects of it as well, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think obviously during the league season it will end up, my guess, being like it was with the Cheetahs and the Southern Kings, and you have these kind of mini tours where you play a couple of games down there and come back. Mm. I don't know if that's feasible with the Heineken Cup, is it? I mean,
no.
Yeah, if you've got, like you say, even if you were to do back-to-back.
It is tricky, isn't it? Because
maybe you just have to face the South Africans away first up, and you face them in October away. Yeah, everyone has to do that. And then,
ideally, if they come up here, they wouldn't want to just play one game and go back. They would play someone else from their pool as well.
But they will be based up here sort of anyway, won't they? Because they'll be playing their league games here as well, of course.
Okay.
I guess. Yeah. But English sides won't be. You know, English sides, like you say, will be, you know, Gloucester, or I don't know why I keep using Gloucester, but Gloucester might be playing Northampton 1 week and then playing the Stormers at home, the Stormers away, and then the following week playing the Stormers at home back in the cold again. It's, yeah, there's a lot of logistics that will have to be figured out between now and the start of the 2022 season.
Who knows? Yeah, something like that.
Don't know. Yeah,
it's 2022, but it's 2022-23.
Yeah, it is. I think. Don't know. Just, yeah, it does. It does feel like we've just lost a whole year of our lives, doesn't it?
Yeah,
yeah. You know, we have. The South African.
I feel like I've lost a whole year of my life every time I watch a Pref 14 game.
It's not over yet, by the way. We might lose another year yet.
The South African sides must be must be really excited by it, coming from sort of what you know, where they've been.
Oh, I don't know. If you're old enough and you played in Super Rugby, are you really going to get excited about playing against Zebra and Connacht and the Dragons when you've been playing the Crusaders and the Blues? And
yeah, but they're not going to play Zebra, Connacht and the Dragons all the time, are they? They're going to play some of the stronger sides, and also, you know, some of the Duff Australian sides that have folded over the years couldn't have been very exciting either. So,
I don't know.
Easier. I know it's a long distance, 11-hour flight for some of them, but it's easier travel because you're on the same time zone and everything. So,
yeah, I think the time zones for them in terms of like that.
Oh, yeah, that's the enjoyment.
Like, is a real horrible one for them. And I think, I don't know. Obviously, I've got no idea, but I get the impression that they'd probably be quite excited by the prospect of, you know, playing different sides, knowing that at the end of it they've got the opportunity of coming into, you know, a superb tournament, really.
The thing is, I don't feel like the Heineken Cup is a superb tournament anymore. I feel like
it was, wasn't it?
Oh, it was, definitely. And yeah. I don't know quite what, I can't quite put my finger on what it is that it's kind of lost its place a little bit. Maybe it's just because we follow the Welsh regions and there hasn't been much to cheer about and you kind of lose that bit of attention. But for a while, it hasn't felt right to me. And again, it goes back to, I can't remember if we had the microphones on when we were talking about this, but, you know, with the Euros going on now, there's too much confusion about who qualifies. I think that the beauty of having a knockout, like the World Cup, for example, you know that the top two teams from each pool qualify and it all lies on that. And I kind of feel like the Heineken Cup suffers from all this nonsense of, you know, if you lose your first two games, you may as well not bother. And there's too much of that goes on. Now, if you make it to the quarterfinals, it can be absolutely brilliant. And, you know, you ask Scarlets fans about those amazing away days, or you ask any, you know, Wasps fans about winning the whole thing, and they'll have amazing memories to talk about it. But I just kind of don't feel like the tournament modernized when it had that opportunity in 2013. It just kind of, France and England tried to stick two fingers up to everyone else and make it a bit more about them. And the tournament had an opportunity to evolve and become a bit easier to follow. And I don't get anywhere near as excited about it now as I did 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with you there. I'm probably guilty of remembering what it was. And yeah, I'm probably not that excited about it really now you mention it. But that's got to be because of how poor our sides have gone. You know, it's almost
definitely part of it.
And you think if any of the Welsh sides got through, you know, we'd all be so much more excited and invested in it, because you'd back any of the, you know, you back any of the Welsh regions, whether you support them or not. You'd want them to win. And you know, how good does it feel with Wales in the football, you know, qualifying to the next round? It just makes the tournament so much more exciting, doesn't it? To have your sides in it.
Yeah, it definitely does. I just think the problem is that I think it's become a bit predictable now. And this is the problem with club rugby to a certain degree, is that you don't get the upsets that you do in football. So if there's more money involved and more money goes to certain sides and they're better funded, the chances of someone causing an upset are so much slimmer now than they ever have been. And unless you create a system that redistributes some of that wealth, and I'm not saying it just should be handouts, but there should be something in place that tries to keep things competitive. And that's why actually that Martin and I talking about there being wage caps, I think is something that's quite encouraging in a way. You know, the Welsh region's got a lot of problems financially, but you know, if you keep fighting and get going, I just think that look, sport is about competition. And like you say, no one took any joy in the Lions beating the Barbarians 87 points to 3 in Hong Kong, because it was a non-event. Nothing happened. The thrill you get from sport is it being a close contest. I don't, at the moment, I just see there being a power play going on across club rugby, and none of them are making enough money. You know, like we said about the English clubs, they're not, they're all making losses. And so actually, and France is heavily funded by sugar daddies and to a certain extent a big broadcast deal, but that's not sustainable. That can't go on forever. And it's not interesting if you know that Leinster are going to win the league every year and that Saracens are going to win the Heineken Cup or whatever it is. It just makes sport not interesting. Whereas at least in the 90s, you didn't. I know there were teams who were dominant, and obviously Bath won the English league a lot, but there were big rivalries and sides could upset them on their day. I don't know. I feel like if that isn't addressed in these crucial next couple of years, then I don't know, then the Welsh sides will kind of drop off the radar of European rugby and might even not, you know, drop off existence completely.
How would you address it, Jed? What would you do?
There's a question when we're trying to wrap up and go and watch the second half of the football.
Murph's gone. he's watching the football.
He's got one eye on it, hasn't he?
I deliberately switched it off when the pod started because I knew I would just zone out and be even more unintelligible than I normally am. So I had to switch it off, I promise.
What would I do? Look, I think, again, I keep coming back to this, and I know CVC are not in this for making the game better, but they're not in it for the, you know, the goodness of their own heart. They're in it to make money. But I do think that competition makes things exciting. So if sides get the opportunity to earn money and then therefore recruit better and have stronger squads all in all, and you have a lot less mismatches, that will produce better competitions, which will excite a lot more casual fans. It will bring in more audiences. It will excite more broadcasters. It will generate more money. You'll sell more tickets. That's the route to kind of creating money, as I see it. More viewers, more popular supporters, more chance of sponsors getting involved. That's how you bring money into the game. So I think there just has to be a structure where there is a cap on wages, so that it's competitive, and you can't have sides with playing budget that's 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times higher than some other sides in the league and expect it to be competitive. So that's part of it, I think. But then also, you know, you need prize money in there that's going to be reflective of that, and something that means that all the sides have an opportunity to spend their money wisely but go out there and earn it when they can cause an upset. I mean, how much money have Treviso realistically bought into them by winning the Rainbow Trout Cup? I can't imagine it's a huge amount. Yet, you know, that is, if anyone cared about the tournament, that's a really good achievement. And I think that's the bit that has to be looked at, is there just needs to be an opportunity to earn money through winning things and performing better and getting better. And there also needs to be something that puts in place a cap on the sides who have the best resources money-wise, to just be able to constantly strengthen their squad, because otherwise you'll have what we have now, and it'll get worse.
So we definitely need some serious intervention.
Yeah, but also, you know, there is not enough money in rugby going round to continually spend that much money on players' wages as it is. Which brings us on, Dan, to the Corey Hill situation.
Yes.
So again, yes. Since we've last
always
spoke,
rely on me.
I can always rely on you, Dan. Since we've last spoke, Corey Hill has withdrawn from the Wales squad to, inverted commas, pursue opportunities abroad, which you would presume mean that he's pretty far down the line if he's withdrawing from the squad. Seems like Japan might be the option for him, and a pretty decent contract awaits for him. So first thing is, Dan, how much of a blow is that to Cardiff and Wales? And secondly, are we going to see more of this?
It's a huge blow to Cardiff. It's also a huge blow to Wales, because he's a fantastic player, isn't he? Fantastic player, fantastic leader, such a smart operator. So, yeah, it's not good news. But with what's going on in Wales, you cannot point a finger at him or lay any blame at his door, can you? It's exactly what it's exactly what he's got to do if he's offered, you know, I don't know, he's rumoured to be offered, what, 750,000? I mean...
Really?
I thought I'd heard half a mil, but... Well, I mean,
holy
Yeah, I saw half a mil. Yeah, exactly. You've got to say good for him. And he's only, you know, he's one training session or one gym session, whatever, away from a from it being called a day. You've got to take it, haven't you? Even if it means that you can't play for your national side. I think it's sad. It is sad, but it's absolutely inevitable, isn't it?
There's a couple of things with this story. One is it's gone quite quiet now. Like it should have. I know we've talked about it. There's not many slow news days in sport at the moment. So, you know, maybe that's why it's not rumbled on in the press or the media or anything. Because, like I say, the announcement was made and then he's just pulling out of the Welsh squad and obviously being bought out of his Blues contract,
not, I believe. So when they renegotiated the 25% pay cut, which lots of players did,
right,
that is believed, or certainly by some agents, seems to be essentially that contract being breached. Therefore, you are able to leave you're able to leave before your contract ending, which that's the bit that could get messy, because this is a one-off. I kind of don't blame Corey Hill for taking, you know, a huge paycheck, like Dan says, when you're only one injury away from it ending. Mm. But that's the bit where it could get messy, that a load of people come sniffing around and it makes that 60 cap rule a little bit vulnerable.
Yeah, well, someone knowledgeable on Twitter, I can't remember who it was now, could have been Steph Thomas, could have been someone else, was trying to suggest that the pay cut, which was unavoidable, there's not much could be done about the pay cut, but the shenanigans around it in terms of late paying and different messing about that's gone on is a major contributing factor to, aside from the huge wages being offered, is a major contributing factor to Corey taking up the offer. And, you know, it is a big step for him personally, because he would have been in the Welsh squad for the next few seasons and then possibly taking on more captaincy roles. And so, you know, sheer weight of money has made him turn all that down, you know. But, someone was trying to suggest that it was something to do with the way the WIU has handled this 25% pay cut and what have you. But and that's why I'm a bit surprised it's gone quiet, because that's like a red rag to journalists.
It's it's a feeding frenzy, isn't it, really?
Yeah, so maybe there is, you know, maybe there is no actual fire to match the smoke. I don't know. But
I think that you know, with the pay cuts, the players had to take, and just the absolute levels of uncertainty that are in the Welsh game, it's got to be really difficult for the players to sort of to concentrate. They've got a contract, but they haven't got a contract. They've got agents saying, look, there's. Because agents drive a lot of these conversations, opportunities, don't they? It's business for the agents as well. And if you're presented with, you know, any of these sorts of sums when you've got absolute uncertainty that's surrounding you, I think it'd be nigh impossible for someone like Corey to turn it down. And the big worry is, isn't it, now that, you know, they this could be the beginning of an exodus of our top players, if it's almost like a loophole for clubs to start sniffing around and taking away our top talent, when it was just starting to, you know, it was just starting to work the other way, wasn't it, with players coming back into Wales, strengthening the regions.
It has worked. It's kept players like Moriarty and, you know, so I'm just thinking of the Dragons, Moriarty and Wainwright and players like that.
Josh Adams
has come back. Jonah Holmes, loads and loads of players. So Prothero, who, you know, was in the English system, but has obviously got an eye on playing for Wales.
Will Rowlands, Will Griff John, Thomas Francis, there's tons, and people don't realise how successful it is at
all. Yeah, it's been brilliant, isn't it?
One of the things that winds me up, I know I've probably mentioned this before, is that there's a school of thought on, you know, Welsh rugby Twitter as it is, that we're arresting the development of some of these players because they could be playing at a higher standard every week in the English league or any league anywhere, I suppose, getting better quality opposition and then being better international players when they come and play for us. But what those people never mention or fail to realise is England don't pick anyone that doesn't play in England. Mm. If you move out of England, you don't play. No matter if you've got 5,000 caps, you will not get picked. No matter how good you are, it happened to Stefan and Delon Armitage. They were both really good at various stages of their career. And because they weren't in England, no chance. And so why are they doing that? Like, if they've got all the resources and all the money, why do they do it? Because it's really important for your league. And that's what, you know, the issue is in this. If you just become an empty bloody development, well, we're in trouble as it is. But yeah, if you've got an empty development league when all your best players are playing somewhere else, it will affect your international side, and obviously it will kill off grassroots, but your local professional team. So there's a reason why they do it. I mean, the French do it as well, and the New Zealanders. One of the best second rows ever couldn't play for New Zealand because he was in Japan, and now he's just moved back to New Zealand. And as soon as he's arrived, they picked him again. So it's not just Wales with this 60 cap rule. The 60 cap rule is actually lenient.
Well, Ireland as well. You know, it's only a few. Yeah, I mean, so obviously Scotland and South Africa don't have that in place. But
only poor countries have to come up with some kind of arrangements where players can go abroad because they've got no economic defence against it. But any other country says no. If you're not playing here, you're not playing for the national side. So there's a reason why countries do it, and you know, obviously. Probably the throbbers who go on about it on Twitter don't listen to this podcast. So I'm not going to get my point across. But I mean, so, you know, but I think the point, what I'm trying to say is I'm right.
Done. Agreed. Dan.
Yeah.
Agree with that one?
Agreed. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. And while we're wrapping up the podcast and talking about transfers, Alex Cuthbert is heading back to Wales while we talk about this. So he's heading to the Ospreys, who have been very heavy in the recruitment market, as we covered on previous podcasts. Dan, A, good bit of business, to use a bit of football parlance there for you, and B, could we see a return to Cuthy in a Wales shirt at some point?
Oh, I'd love to see that. Just because
it would be a massive like redemption story. It would be like
well, it would.
It'd be brilliant.
It was the type of thing you make a film about because you know he was persona non grata there for a while. Mm.
So we could make a film about it.
there's a lot more competition now in the wing.
There is.
So. He'd have to be right on his very best 2013 form to break into the Welsh side.
Yeah.
How good was his form though then? I mean, when you look back over, it's so easy to forget, isn't it?
Well, for a guy who was a novice, really, he went from, you know, was he captain his first season at Cardiff? I think he was, wasn't he? I think he basically was playing on the wing for Cardiff, had whatever it was, 15 games, and then became Shane's replacement.
Well, I think it was earlier than that. I think he was earmarked in the Welsh Sevens.
That's right, of course.
He broke all sorts of as it was then try scoring records for Wales in a seventh season, I think, or in one tournament he broke some sort of record, and they flagged him up straight away, and then he was almost in the Welsh squad before he'd even had a game, many games for Cardiff. So he was so needed at the time when he came along, because we had lost Mark Jones, I think. Is it that far back? I don't know.
Shane. Shane went after the 2011 World Cup. He retired, and Cuthbert basically took the spot. Didn't he? George moved from one wing to the other, and Cuthbert took the other slot.
Yeah. So yeah, good luck to him. Anyway, I mean, he lives in Cardiff somewhere, probably Poncana, because only professional sports people can afford to live in Poncana. Yeah, good luck to him. If he lives in Boncana, that usually means you've got to play for the Scarlets, because that's where most of the Scarlets
are. Well, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah. But yeah, he's, I don't know. I think I don't know. I think the Wales thing is probably a little way off, like you say, because there's a lot more competition in those positions now.
Well, even George North can't get on the Welsh side on the wing anymore.
Yeah, so, exactly. You know, but I think for the Ospreys, it gives them a load of experience. And do you know what I would say to him as well is I think fair play for coming back to Wales, because it's the, you know, we've covered this, Dan, before, haven't we? When we first started the podcast, that was the end of Alex Cuthbert's time in a Wales shirt, and he was having a torrid time, and he basically should have been playing club rugby rather than international rugby to try and recover his form and some confidence. But to be able to then say, do you know what, I'm coming back and I'm playing, you know, I'm going to come and play in Wales, when he probably doesn't need to financially. He's probably had a good couple of years at Exeter. He's probably had a good few contracts and a good few appearance fees and win bonuses for Wales that he probably doesn't need to, at this stage in his career, to come over to Wales when he could go and get a gig somewhere else in England, in France, in Japan, even, as we said. I don't know, either he's really hungry to get back in a red shirt, or he just feels like he's got a point to prove here. And you know, good luck to him. I think when he's playing his best rugby, he's a lethal finisher, not just a big, strong, you know, ball carrier. It's his finishing ability that I think is what has always been his strength, is when he's got a sniff of the line, he does a really good job of putting tries away. So I think it will be a good sign that the Ospreys, and they're building a strong squad for next season.
They are building a strong squad. And I feel that part of that is a big reason in why why you would have decided to go there as well. Obviously there's a few pound notes floating around, but it's quite exciting what's going on down at the Ospreys, isn't it? On the field. And you know, maybe it's probably time for a different podcast on this, but what they're doing off the field is as exciting as on it, isn't it? So there's a lot happening there, isn't there?
There is, and I'm sure we will cover that in weeks to come. Stick with us. We'll be back next week. We'll be back on Monday, in fact, with a reaction to the first Lions game of the tour, or not of the tour, but the first Lions game of what will soon be the tour. Thanks to both Dan and Murph for joining me. Big thanks, as always, to our sponsors at So Coffee Trades. If you want to get some great quality coffee, then make sure you head over to socoffeetrades.co.uk in order to do that. Dan Killick is looking intently at the camera, which is hugely scary. It's like the Blair Witch Project, but with some kind of Cowbridge twist to it. I don't know, the Ben Blair Witch Project. But then we've also got loads more rugby to talk to you about as well. We'll be here throughout the Lions tour. So make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, so that if we do create some bonus episodes, you won't miss out on them. And hopefully we've got a couple of top quality guests lined up, including a couple of Lions themselves. So yeah, be sure to stick with us, and we'll be back to chat rugby with you very, very soon.
Podcast Network.